Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my honor and privilege to present Martin A. Lee, the author of the just-released The Beast Reawakens, published in hardcover by Little Brown Books, a seminal work and a landmark work talking about the reemergence of fascism all around the globe. Martin, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you very much.
What I'd like to do is to recap a couple of the points. We covered a lot of the ground that you touch on in your vitally important book in our first interview. For the benefit, however, of those who have not heard that first interview, I'd like to discuss a long-standing geopolitical dynamic with regard to German foreign policy of alignment with Russia. Could you tell us a little bit about its history and what that entails, and then we're going to trace that on, right on up through the present time?
Germany, because it is situated right in the middle of Europe, has always played, or has always been able to relate both equally to East and to West. And in terms of relating to the East, this has been a very important tendency in German history because going back to Bismarck, who was really the key person who unifies the German state and makes it into a nation state in the 1870s, Bismarck counseled his fellow countrymen that Germany's interests should never collide or conflict with Russia's. The reason being is that Germany, although it is strategically situated in the middle of Europe, is not a wealthy country in terms of natural resources. Yet when it looks to the east, it sees areas of vast wealth in terms of natural resources, in particular Russia. The eastern countries in Eastern Europe and Russia also present potentially lucrative markets for Germany to market its industrial goods, since Germany has been an economic powerhouse as compared to its neighbors in the east that are relatively are not as developed or haven't been in terms of industrial power. So because of that dynamic, Russia has something that Germany needs. Germany has something that Russia needs. So going back in history, there has been this this powerful historical imperative. It even goes back before Bismarck to the time of Frederick the Great back in the 1700s. He also advocated this kind of alliance between the Prussian and the Russian monarchy that was codified in several royal marriages between the, you know, between both royal families. So this is something, again, that goes back and has a very powerful imperative in German history.
We talked about how Nazi elements that went to work ostensibly, at least, for our intelligence service. They were working for our intelligence services. However, they were also playing a double game. They also, however, continued to utilize this German-Russian dynamic in terms of their realpolitik and continued to play footsie, so to speak, with the Soviet Union. They were playing a double game. We talked in our first interview about how they were able to a certain extent, influence the United States to circumvent denazification. Of course, their anti-communist sentiments and some of the ties between powerful American corporate interests and their German counterparts played a role in there. We now see, as we look back from the vantage point of 1997, not only some of the recalcitrant Nazi elements in Germany. This is not to imply that Germany is Nazi, but it's showing some of the same disturbing tendencies. We are also witnessing, in terms of German economic and foreign policy, an old machination and something which has echoed throughout German history, namely the Drang nach Osten. Could you tell us a little bit more about what that means and how this new Drang nach Osten differs from the last?
The Drang nach Osten is the drive to the east. In past years, that has taken on a military dimension and it's been very, very destructive. It doesn't have that kind of focus these days. It's more of an economic drive to the east that you see Germany being involved in a very careful way. I mean, Germany has its own economic problems right now. Unemployment is very high. The cost for unifying the two Germanys, east and west, is staggering. So it has to deal with its own situation. But at the same time, it has been investing quite strategically and selectively in certain key industries and in certain key economic sectors like media, communications, and so forth and so on. And it's been doing that in various countries in Eastern Europe to the point where it really has been able to exert a very powerful interest through its economic investments in Eastern European countries and in Russia as well. So it has a great deal of political influence now in those countries because of the economic influence it exerts.
To a certain extent, some of the German neo-Nazi elements and also some of the German institutions, their corporations and their government, have been working in a parallel fashion in this particular regard. You discussed that in your book. I wonder if you would elaborate on that for us.
Yeah, in a sense, what the neo-Nazis in Germany have been doing has been a very extreme version of some of the policies that the German government has itself been pursuing. You can see that in terms of the anti-immigrant sentiment, both within the government and within neo-Nazi circles, and also in terms of the economic, quote-unquote, drive to the east. There is a powerful element in German society politically called the Vertriebenen, the expellees, those German ethnics who were expelled from neighboring countries on the eastern borders of Germany right after World War II. About 20 to 25% of the people in Germany today would be classified as either expellees or the sons and daughters of people who had been expelled from neighboring countries. And this formed a very powerful political lobby in Germany, and the expellees, the Vertriebenen groups, tended to be extreme right-wing, very militant. Several of these organizations, which are receive quite a bit of funding from the German government itself, were founded by former, quote-unquote, Nazis after the war, and they agitated for expanding German influence, in some cases explicitly retaking territory to the east of Germany's borders. So the Vertriebenen organizations want to take back Silesia, that region in Poland, which is heavily Germanic. They want to take back Sudetenland in what is now in the Czech Republic and make that part of Germany again. Also, Kaliningrad, which the Germans is Königsberg, they want that region back again. And these are elements within German society that agitate for this kind of action and policy. And the important thing here to remember is that they are funded by the German government. And the German government itself sort of is of a schizophrenic mind about this, it seems. So on the one hand, German officials will somewhat reluctantly concede that, yes, the borders that are currently in place in Germany are the borders we must respect. And yet when you look back to 1973, you find that the German Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe actually ruled explicitly that the 1937 borders, when Hitler was in power, are the real German borders. And these stand today. That ruling is part, you know, it's part of the government, the Constitutional Court. So the government sort of speaks with two voices on this question. And it's very disturbing to some of Germany's neighbors.
One of the individuals involved with one of the most powerful of the Vertriebenen groups, the Witkobund, was Eduard Lintner. And that's an interesting person to be involved with such an organization.
Yes, it is, because Eduard Lintner is the deputy interior minister for all of Germany. Germany is a federalized state, as country, so it has different regions, different states, or Länder, as they call them, each with their own interior ministries, but they also have a national interior ministry for the whole country. And Lintner is the number two man in that department. And while one of his jobs, ironically enough, it was to track and monitor neo-Nazi activity in Germany, he himself was the leader of a Vertriebenen group that is called the Sudetendeutsche Landmannschaft.
Oh, that's right. The Witkobund was its earlier reincarnation.
Well, actually, the Sudeten-German Landmannschaft, which is one of these Vertriebenen organizations, was collaborating with the Witkobund. This is another organization which is explicitly pro-Nazi and pro-fascist in its political sentiments and rhetoric and activities. And yet you have a organization, this Sudeten-German Landmannschaft, being funded by the German government, being led by a high-ranking official of the German government that's supposed to track Nazi activity, and yet this organization itself is involved in collaborating with neo-Nazi, neo-fascist, extreme right-wing groups in terms of trying to agitate for renewed and expanded German interest in Sudetenland.
You write of the VDA, another institution which was actually banned at Nuremberg, and its role in the Drang nach Osten.
This was banned in at Nuremberg, but then it was reformed in 1955, and this is actually a fascinating organization. Had I had more time and space in the book, it's a 500-page book, I would have actually devoted more attention to that. But this is an organization that agitates and advocates for German influence in various different countries wherever ethnic Germans happen to live. So whereas a particular Vertriebenen organization might focus on Silesia or Königsberg or the Sudetenland or another area, East Prussia, The VDA that you just mentioned really has as its target, you know, all these different countries, wherever Germans may live. One of the policies that they've been promoting very quietly has been a land grab in the Kaliningrad region. Again, Kaliningrad or Königsberg is that area of what is now under Russian control. It's this Baltic seaport that remained a part of Russia, even though it is not geographically contiguous with the mass of Russia itself. It's bordered by the Baltic states, Lithuania and so forth. Yet this remained a part of Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it had been, prior to the Cold War, a part of Prussia. So the Germans are eyeing that part of the world, and they want that back as a part of Germany. And while the German government officials will talk about how it would be nice to have it back again, you have the Vertriebenen groups that are actually, you know, agitating on the ground to make it happen.
One of the bibliographical sources that you reference, Reunited Germany, The New Danger, distributed by the Searchlight magazine and the Antifa Infoblatt in Germany, they mentioned that the VDA, in addition to getting German funding, actually has Horst Waffenschmidt, a junior cabinet minister, sitting on its advisory board.
Yes, it's very significant. Again, it's similar to the situation with Eduard Linter being deputy interior minister and also being a leader of one of these Vertriebenen groups. So you have Horst Waffenschmidt, a very powerful figure in the German government, as being one of the leaders of the VDA. So it underscores how you have these connections between the German government and extremist organizations, that right-wing extremism or neo-fascism or neo-Nazi in Germany is not something that's simply out of the government, outside of the government. It overlaps in various ways. The extremism has become mainstream to a large degree in Germany, and this is one example of that taking place.
We spoke earlier about the parallel, and perhaps that's the wrong word. Maybe they're really two sides of the same coin. But the activities of major German institutions, governmental and industrial and financial, and also the activities of the neo-Nazi organizations. One of the areas where the German fascist organizations, not only some of the so-called neo-Nazis such as Ewald Altans, but also some of the older groups, people like Gerhard Frey, have been very active, is inside of parts of the former Soviet Union.
Oh, yes. Once the Soviet Union collapsed, this was considered a prime target for neo-Nazi militants, and many different organizations sent their representatives, their neo-Nazi representatives now, to the Ukraine, to Russia, to Belarus. Russia was considered the real top prize here, and several people went over there to, again, reenact or re-evoke or re-establish that Bismarckian framework of a German-Russian alliance. We saw it briefly when Hitler and Stalin had their pact during the Third Reich. But again, this is some going back for several centuries in German history, and even though in West Germany many Nazis after the war thought the best way to get back on their feet and rebuild the country was to emphasize their anti-communist credentials and cut a deal with the West, in the United States in particular, in some cases that meant actually working for the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies. I think that you had sort of one side going on, but a very, very powerful current and tendency has always been to never forget this importance of the German-Russian alliance. So that was reenacted again once the Soviet Union collapsed, and people like Ewald Altans, who was one of the up-and-coming German leaders until he was jailed a couple of years ago, he traveled several times to Germany and met with from Germany to Russia and met with Russian fascist groups, Russian Nazi groups, former members of the KGB who were gravitating toward a quote-unquote patriotic or nationalist stance. And these connections, in some cases, bore very, very interesting fruit.
Altans was actually a protege of Otto Ernst Rehmer, the SS officer and Odessa leader that we talked about in our first interview.
Yes, and Otto Ernst Rehmer, a very, very important figure in the Third Reich and also in the post-war period. He was the key figure who squashed the attempt to basically to rebel against Hitler. And there was an assassination plot in July 20th, 1944, and a coup attempt that followed failed assassination attempt. And Rehmer was instrumental in suppressing the coup plot, and he went on to become Hitler's chief bodyguard from that point on. And in the post-war period, he was very active in neo-Nazi politics, first in West Germany, then he lived for a long period in Syria and the Arab world. He had a lot of business contacts there. Then he came back to Germany in the early 80s, and he, above all else, was a very outspoken proponent of this German-Russian alliance. He said even though the Soviet Union was communist, this was during the Cold War, that shouldn't matter. The ideological differences had to be overcome. It was a sort of a problem because the Soviet Union was communist, but ultimately the national interests of the two countries would supersede the ideological differences. And this is something that Reymer, who is still alive, by the way, and living in Spain now in exile, he agitated for this German-Russian alliance most vociferously, I think, of any neo-Nazi after the war, any Nazi, I should say.
Now, with regard to not only the Drang nach Osten and German policy vis-a-vis Russia, but also some of the disturbing politics that loom on the Russian horizon, you write of fascists in Russia and some of their connections with their German counterparts, Vladimir Zhirinovsky and the aforementioned Gerhard Fry. Tell us not only about each of them individually, but the relationship between them.
Well, Vladimir Zhirinovsky is probably the most well-known Russian fascist because his party, the misnamed Liberal Democratic Party in Russia, did very well in elections in December 1993. They essentially won the parliamentary elections. They took 25% of the vote, which is far more than any other political party in Russia at the time. It really sent shockwaves around the world. Zhirinovsky's principal contact in Germany among the extreme right was Gerhard Fry's group, the DVU, Deutsche Volksunion. Now, what's very interesting about the DVU is that during the Cold War, unlike many other neo-Nazi groups, the DVU, which has been explicitly described, incidentally, as a Nazi organization by U.S. Army intelligence documents, the DVU took a pro-NATO, pro-Western, pro-Atlanticist stance. Most Nazi groups in Germany did not take that kind of position. They took either a third position against both East and West, against both capitalism and communism, or they pursued this German-Russian alliance type of scenario. So the DVU is sort of like the black sheep in that sense of an overtly articulated Nazi group. I'm not speaking now about those Nazis that started to regain their government positions in Germany and began working in the Bonn Republic. You know, they couldn't flaunt the fact that they had Nazi ideas, some of them, so they sort of played that part of it low-key. But DVU was right out in front, led by Gerhard Fry. And after the Cold War, however, they do an about-face, 180 degrees, and they come out supporting very strongly this idea of a German-Russian alliance. And I think that as embodied by Gerhard Frey's close relationship with Zhirinovsky, and Frey is a very wealthy publisher and businessman, he was giving money to Zhirinovsky's political party in Russia. And, of course, by associating with Zhirinovsky and hosting several conferences of the DVU where Zhirinovsky spoke in Germany, Gerhard Frey got a lot of attention, got a lot of publicity in his own country, and it helped his party grow somewhat. So the key point here is that the DVU, while it had been pro-NATO during the Cold War, once the Cold War ends, it does an about-face and takes this position of the Bismarckian pro-German-Russian alliance. And it shows how skin-deep that alliance with the West really was during the Cold War.
Now, Fry's Deutsche Nationalzeitung and Soldatenzeitung actually had some SS former SS officers and veterans of Goebbels' propaganda ministry on its editorial board. That name familiar to many of the veteran listeners because it crops up in the context of President Kennedy's assassination. You mentioned that Vladimir Zhirinovsky was the best known of the Russian fascists, but you write in The Beast Reawakens of other Russian fascists, and beyond that, fascists in other parts of the Soviet Union. Mr. Limonov.
Well, Eduard Limonov is quite interesting. He would deny that he's a fascist. He would say that he is a national Bolshevik, which he'd say is different from fascism. And he spoke very frankly about this when I interviewed him. I actually caught up with him in Paris a few years back. He's a novelist by profession, and he had spent a lot of time as a dissident living in both the United States and New York City and in Paris while the Soviet Union was still the Soviet Union. It was only after its collapse that Limonov went back to his country in Russia, and he began to be involved in politics there. And he formed a group called the National Bolshevik Front. And he told me when I asked him about, well, isn't that sort of a kind of fascism? He said, no, fascism in Russia is a dirty word. If you say you're a fascist, you'll never get anywhere politically because of what happened during World War II. The memory of that in Russia is still very, very strong. But I think that national Bolshevism as a tendency, as a political tendency in Russia, which is rather long-standing, in some ways is a kind of functional equivalent of a fascist movement or a fascist organization. In fact, Eduard Limonov made explicit alliances with overt neo-Nazis such as Alexander Barkashov in Russia, who is probably the leading neo-Nazi in Russia. He runs a group called the Russian National Union, which is, again, probably the most important outright neo-Nazi group. So even though Limonov claimed that he wasn't a fascist, and he claimed that fascism couldn't really get any political mileage in Russia, he still nevertheless formed an alliance with outright fascists, outspoken fascists such as Barkashov.
You mentioned that some elements of the KGB during the declining phases of the Soviet Union actually served as nests for nurturing some of these national Bolsheviks, a term which, by the way, also dates back to the Konservative Revolution in Weimar Germany between the wars, and some of the nascent fascists in Russia.
Yes, it's a very interesting phenomenon. I mean, one of the key KGB figures or former KGB figures involved in this, what they would call the red-brown politics, neo-communists and extreme right-wing nationalists who formed an alliance in opposition to Yeltsin when Yeltsin seized power in what I would call a coup on his own part. And the red-brown alliance, an element of that is what I'm calling national Bolshevism. You know, one could spend a long time talking about this. It's a very interesting phenomenon. But essentially, the national Bolshevists felt that, it's a tendency that existed both within dissident circles in Russia and within the Russian government itself. And within the Russian government, that there had been a tendency that sort of waxed and waned over the years that felt that, communism is one thing, but the important thing is Russian nationalism. The important thing is a strong, powerful Russian state, and whether it's communist or otherwise, it didn't really matter, but it's the power of the state what mattered. And so whether it had communist trappings or not, they could do without that, quite frankly, but they would sort of go along with it as long as the Soviet Union was still communist. Well, after the collapse of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, that national Bolshevik tendency emerged in a very powerful way as something that attracted many nationalists and anti-communists even. So it's a very interesting tendency. You mentioned the conservative revolution back in the 1920s in Germany and also in other countries in Europe. National Bolshevism was a kind of fascism that was percolating during this period in Germany. It was one of many variants of fascism that was percolating, including, of course, National Socialism at the time. But
it was actually very much oriented towards an alliance with the East along the lines of the Bismarckian edict.
Yes, and I think most of the tendencies within the conservative revolution had this Eastern-oriented program. I mean, that was a pretty much an accepted geopolitical fact. A few would argue with that. Whatever side of the political spectrum you are in Germany, people understood that that was important, that went beyond, again, ideological questions of the Soviet Union being a communist country, Germany being a capitalist country, and so forth. But in Germany, the national Bolshevik tendency was more, I mean, it was never that powerful compared to some of the other variants of fascism, and certainly compared to National Socialism. The key figure there is Ernst Niekisch in Germany, and another national Bolshevik proponent was the great German writer, at least was considered a great writer, Ernst Jünger. So this was a kind of a intellectual curiosity more than anything as compared to what ended up being national Bolshevism in the Soviet Union, which became, again, a very powerful force both inside and outside the government.
One of the interesting elements of the German and Soviet past that you write about is that with both nations being pariah nations at the end of World War I, much of the key early German rearmament actually took place clandestinely inside of the former Soviet Union.
Yes, this is under the auspices of the famous Rapallo Pact between Germany and Russia. And again, here's an example. This Rapallo Pact was codified in the early 1920s when two outcast countries after World War I realized they needed each other. Germany needed a place to test its new military armaments, and the Russian steps were perfect for that. And there was a way that they could circumvent the restrictions imposed by Versailles, both the military and economic restrictions. So they looked to Russia as a place to do this. The Red Army, on the other hand, they needed to you know, really become a modern army, a modern force, rather than just a sort of a civil war army. And they looked to the Germans for military expertise and teaching. So they sort of traded off. And also, again, there was an very important economic element to the Rapallo Treaty, the Rapallo Pact. And I think it was a way that the Germans were able to sort of hoodwink the Western countries that imposed the Versailles restrictions on them. And because in the West, the feeling was, well, gee, you know, Soviet Union, it's communist. You know, capitalist Germany would never cut a deal with them. I mean, we don't have to worry about that. And so it went on largely behind the back of the rest of the world. And it was it had very positive results for both countries in terms of strengthening Russia and Germany. The irony is, when Stalin was double-crossed by Hitler after the Stalin-Hitler pact was broken and Hitler's army invaded the Soviet Union, some of the weapons that the Nazis were using to pound the Soviets were weapons that had been produced in factories inside the Soviet Union that the Germans had set up as a part of this Rapallo pact. So again, it's one of those historical ironies that unfolded.
One wonders, too, about what the sense of national humiliation, not to mention the tremendous economic and social dislocation that has taken place inside Russia and some of the other former Soviet republics, might have in the 1990s and the next century, whether perhaps we might see a return of fascism in the former Soviet Union. We've just got a couple of minutes left, Martin, on this side. You also write of disturbing tendencies in the Ukraine and in the Baltic republics, where former Waffen SS units and some of their leaders have been honored.
Yes, that has happened both in Latvia, one of the places, and in the Ukraine, where former members of Waffen SS units in those countries have been welcomed back with open arms. Many of these people had lived in the West, so to speak, and were working with Western intelligence agencies against the communist bloc during the Cold War. Once the communist bloc disintegrates, they were welcomed back to their home countries, and these are people that have a very bloody record in their past.
And you mentioned that the governments of both the Ukraine and some of the Baltic republics actually sanctioned these types of activities.
Not only sanctioned, but participated in the ceremonies, welcomed back, and honored these people in various ways. So this is not something that just happened in spite of what the government wanted. This is with active, full support of the government in Ukraine and in Latvia, to cite two examples.
You mentioned in Latvia, not only as an exiled German fascist fleeing German justice, now emerging as a political power, but they've actually revived a pro-fascist militia organization in Latvia.
Yes, it's true. They actually... these people parade around in the old uniforms that the Latvians used to wear during World War II when they were allied with Hitler, as if Hitler never even lost the war. I mean, it's quite something. It's quite shocking. And what's even most shocking of all, to my mind, is that the German government had voted to pay the members of the Latvian Waffen SS division a stipend, as a way of sort of keeping them going At the same time, they have not sought to give any kind of financial recompense to the victims of the Latvian Waffen SS, particularly the Jewish victims who suffered as a result of the Nazi period.
We've been speaking with Martin Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens, just issued now by Little Brown Books in hardcover. For Martin Lee, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.